You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Greetings, everybody. This is CJ, and welcome back to the Dangerous History Podcast. In this episode, we're going to be doing a review and discussion of an oldie but a goodie when it comes to movies, and that is the 1992 feature film Unforgiven, directed by and starring Clint Eastwood, which just recently, in August of 2022, celebrated its 30-year release anniversary, and so I was able to track down and get on the Zoom for a while my good internet buddy. Hopefully one day I'll get to shake his hand in person, but longtime internet buddy and friend of the show, Joshua Perry of, well, formerly of the late lamented Dusty Den podcast. Yes, if you don't know, he used to do a podcast called the Dusty Den years ago that was mostly talking about books, both fiction and nonfiction, but also occasionally movies too. And back when his podcast was still active, he and I collaborated multiple times with crossover episodes and things. So anyway, when I realized near the end of August that it was the 30-year anniversary of the release of Unforgiven, I decided that I really wanted to do an episode about it, and it quickly occurred to me that my good buddy Josh Perry would be a good person to talk to about this movie, because like me, he's a big fan of Westerns. But before I switch it over to our conversation, I do just want to say I'm continuing to be very busy behind the scenes, kind of dealing with still the transition on multiple levels to being a full-time podcaster and independent content creator. So I appreciate everybody's patience that, you know, my output has started to ramp up a little bit, but it's still not where it's going to be eventually. And also your patience as far as my fulfilling of the perks from the Indiegogo campaign. Now, I am going to start one of the types of perks with this episode, which is giving shout outs to people who contributed at least $25 or more to the campaign and who selected, you know, a shout out on an episode of the show as a perk. And I'll be doing those, I think, 20 at a time until I've run through all the list. And I'm doing it in the order in which they contributed. So I'm not doing it in any sort of rank order by amount from smallest to biggest or anything like that. It's simply time from, you know, the first person to throw down 25 or more to the last person who did so while the Indiegogo campaign was running, which enabled me to purchase my freedom and start doing this as my full-time career. So thank you sincerely to everybody who contributed to the Indiegogo campaign, even those who gave less than $25. I do appreciate every contribution, great or small. But here are the names of the first 20 excellent individuals that threw down $25 or more to my Indiegogo campaign. And I'm just going to go, you know, with first and last name as I see it there in Indiegogo. And, you know, there's a few people that contributed under what are obviously not real names. And in those cases, I will just read those as they appear. So the first 20 awesome individuals to contribute $25 or more to my Indiegogo campaign to make Dangerous History a full-time endeavor, which almost doubled its original goal in terms of funding, are as follows. Humongous thanks from me to Skyjumper, Skip Pacheco, Dan Taylor, Thomas Phillips, Andrew B., Paul Amodia, Christopher Hopkins, Dropset Waits, David Jeffries, Michael Plute, Henry Bingaman, Jeff Hansen, James Jeniman, Devin Close, James Landers, K.H. Miller, Steve Gasser, Andrew Castellano, Sherwood Smith, and Rod Hoff. Again, thank all of you very, very much for helping me to buy my freedom. and do this kind of stuff full time going forward. And apologies if I messed up anybody's name in terms of pronunciation or what have you. But anyway, thank all of you very much. And now let's go ahead and get to my discussion with Josh Perry about the movie Unforgiven. You know, when I talk about movies and TV on this show, which I do from time to time, it's usually, especially in the last few years, about how most of the things coming out these days are crap. And I think still most of the things coming out these days are crap, with the occasional notable exception. But it was nice to talk about something, even though it's a movie 30 years old, but something that is just an excellent piece of cinema that reminds you that movies don't always have to suck. So, turning it over to the conversation I had with Josh Perry about Unforgiven. Going on a couple weeks ago, I got a little bit sidetracked in processing this episode, but I hope you enjoy, and take care, and I'll talk to you all again soon. Okay, so 30 years and 1 month ago tomorrow was the initial release date of Unforgiven, if I'm not mistaken. So we missed the 30-year anniversary by a little bit, but I didn't realize it till near the end of August, and we couldn't get a time until early September, but oh well, we can still talk about it. So Unforgiven, 1992, directed by and starring Clint Eastwood, won Best Picture and a bunch of other Oscars that year. Eastwood was nominated for Best Actor, but lost to Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman. But let's see, Gene Hackman did win for Best Supporting Actor, deservedly so. Yeah, so initial thoughts on Unforgiven. I know you watched it sometime in the last week or so. Was it your first time viewing it in a long time, or had you watched it fairly recently?
It was the first time in a while. I feel like this is one of those films that I watch maybe every handful of years, like probably every 5 years or something like that. It just seems to, I get the itch. I get the urge to watch it. Obviously, you know, we've talked several times about my love and our love of Westerns and the archetypes, the figures that you see in these kind of films and stories. And I think that this is probably one that I would put up there, though it's very different and almost anti some of the other kind of Westerns that I like in a way. And I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit, but I put it up there with Once Upon a Time in the West and some other true classics that I really care about and love. So to me, this is like a true classic movie. Like, this is one that's going to be around forever and something that people always talk about when they talk about Westerns. And it's just as good now when you watch it, I think, as the first time, or as it was 30 years ago. It's just as powerful. It's got a very timeless quality to it.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat with you as far as it's one of those movies that I rewatch every few years too. And, you know, it had probably been a couple of years since the last time I saw it when I rewatched it recently. I have a hard time ranking my favorite movies, like rank ordering them. But it's definitely in my top five for sure. Up there with things like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is probably the most recent movie that's in my top five. Let's see, some very different. I have a very diverse top five. I've got I would say Big Trouble in Little China is definitely in the top five. One that might actually surprise some people, Legend, the Ridley Scott film with Tom Cruise. Good. Yeah, I think that one is very underrated. But anyway,
Ridley's unbelievable. There are scenes in his movies that are like incredible to me. The way he's so visual, you know, with his direction style, and even when you watch like a lot of special features, because you know I love Alien. Alien is I'm a huge fan of that, and Blade Runner, and when you listen to the actors talk about working with Ridley Scott, like they all say, they're like, he's very unconcerned with the acting and the being a micromanager of the actors. He's like, look, this is your job. He's like, you do your performance. I have a performance to do, which is put in, you know, the visuals up on the screen and stuff and making it look amazing and transporting the viewer to these worlds, which he does. Like nobody else does. I don't think so. I think Ridley Scott is amazing, and he's definitely, he might be my favorite director, really. Everything he does, I like. Even, I don't care how many Alien movies he does, they are all good to me. Like I like the way he does it. I like the way he tells a story. I like the way he paces a film. Even if they're not all perfect, I think they're all really good. If Ridley Scott's name is on it, it's pretty much going to be enjoyable. And it's sure that you could say the same thing for Clint Eastwood. He doesn't have a lot of directorial credits, but for sure, in Unforgiven, I mean, this was very much like a lot of my favorite films, and I have trouble ranking them also, but a lot of them are kind of like auteur driven. And what I mean by that is they're very much a singular vision with other people bringing their best to the project. And Unforgiven is one of those. It's Clint Eastwood. Starring, direct, written, produced, like, you know, all the credits are him. There are other people share them as well, but he's the lead visionary, like a lot of these great films.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Yeah, I've seen most of the films that Eastwood has directed, and you know, some of them he's in and some of them he's not as an actor. There's a few I haven't, but this one's great. Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, a very different movie. He's not in that one. His daughter actually is, though. That's another movie. It's probably in my top 10. Gran Torino, great movie.
Yeah, that's really good.
Oh, one that I rewatched recently, with one of my kids, and the first time I'd rewatched it in probably a decade, Million Dollar Baby. That is a really good movie too.
Yeah. It's really powerful. Moving film. Yeah.
Yeah. So, haven't seen American Sniper. Don't have a huge desire to see American Sniper. But what was the other one? The one about Richard Jewell. That was a Eastwood directed one not too many years ago. That one was pretty good too. But anyway, so Unforgiven was written by a screenwriter named David Peoples. And I don't know if you know this, but David Peoples also was one of the writers on Blade Runner.
He was, so, yeah.
Yeah, there's a Ridley Scott connection. And aside from this, some other stuff I haven't seen, but among the ones I have seen that he wrote would be 12 Monkeys and Soldier, the Kurt Russell film from the late 90s, which I need to rewatch that one. I remember thinking it was pretty good and kind of didn't get the attention it deserved. Sort of some similarities to Universal Soldier, but I think I remember thinking it was a better movie, even though it was less fancy than Universal Soldier. Yeah. But
People's, I think People's worked with a guy named Hampton Fincher or Fancher. I can't remember who the other writer was, but yeah, he was. There were two of them, I think, that ended up writing Blade Runner. So yeah, he's got some credits in the industry.
Yeah. And I just this morning, before I started, to be a masochist, before I started watching some of Amazon's Rings of Wokeness, I was watching some of the special features. I've got the, you know, fancy DVD, you know, two disc set of Unforgiven from like a decade ago, and, you know, watching some of the making of stuff and whatever. And they had people's, you know, talking about writing the film and whatever. It's very interesting. You can tell like he's a really good writer, just even by the way he kind of spoke about it and everything. But you know, spoilers for a movie of 30 years ago, right? I mean, if anybody listening to this hasn't seen it yet and really cares about spoiling a 30-year-old movie, like, stop now and go watch it. And anybody listening, if you haven't watched Unforgiven, like, just go watch it right away. It's, you know, one of the greatest movies ever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're in, I think it's supposed to be the 1880s, and we're in Big Whiskey. And right off the bat, I mean, this movie is very much genre deconstructionist, and it's genre deconstruction done, in my opinion, right and done well, and not done in the way that deconstruction is done these days with the woke cult and all that. But right off the bat, you're starting off with a completely different, you know, problem or dilemma than you get in just about any other Western, right? I mean, you've got cowboys in a whorehouse, and one of them starts attacking a whore for apparently laughing at his unimpressive manhood. So right there, like, that's not the typical, you know, start of a John Wayne movie or something like that, right?
Right. Well, and even like the I tend to view this film as like in a very meta kind of way. To me, it's kind of a very self-aware Western. It's more than just the story. And I think that's very intentional, that I don't think it's happenstance that is the thing that sets the story in motion, is that it's a whore laughing at a cowboy's, you know, genitalia or small wiener.
Yeah.
to be a little more, contemporary. But I think that is very intentional, that's something that you typically associate with Westerns, is kind of like the machismo of the cowboy and the sort of masculinity in overdrive or whatever, or something like that. And that's what's kind of being called into question, like right in the very beginning, is a whore, like, sort of intellectually attacking this cowboy. And it brings with it sort of this tidal wave of violence and these other themes. So I definitely think it's very much on purpose. They could have made the insult to anything, you know, but when you're making a decision like this, when you're writing a story or a film or anything, these are very conscious elements. I don't think it's just some arbitrary thing like, oh, okay, we got to get this whore to insult the cowboy somehow. I think it's very much more, there's more layers to it than that.
Yeah. And, you know, the horror isn't like being malicious. She's like kind of innocent, you know, in right. Like she just unselfconsciously laughs, supposedly. And, you know, she wasn't like trying to put the guy down in the way that, I mean, you can just imagine if they remade Unforgiven today, like how much they'd fuck it up. But, you know, they'd probably have the whore being like a really nasty, you know, sort of typical, unlikable feminist, character, who's being mean deliberately and, you know, whatever. And then of course, they wouldn't have, you know, men come in to get the bounty on the cowboy. They would have the whores themselves, probably.
She'd be a superhero.
Yeah, yeah, probably with like little to no practice or training or whatever, all of a sudden the whores would be, you know, the greatest gunfighters of the West, and, you know, they'd all be checking all kinds of ethnic boxes and whatever. But yeah, so the whores then band together and put together a bounty because the sheriff of the town, Little Bill, played exquisitely by Gene Hackman, who's just, you know, one of the greatest actors of all time, does not sufficiently punish the cowboys to the liking of the whores. So they decide to take matters into their own hands, and it's done realistically, right? Instead of as they would today with like a feminist Unforgiven, you know, modern feminist. There's obviously feminist themes in Unforgiven, but I think they're done well and organically and believably. Yeah. They're not done stupidly like they are today usually. You know, unlike today where they would have the whores suddenly become gunfighters, they actually instead do something that's much more realistic, which is, well, let's pull together our funds from the Johns and, you know, hire someone who actually might be able to kill a couple of cowboys. But and I just want to say the movie, I mean, it's fabulously written, fabulously directed. Like, everything about it is good. The soundtrack's great. But really what shines to me, other than the script and the story itself, are the actors. Like, every actor in this film is just, you know, perfect. I mean,
Frances Fisher plays Strawberry Alice, who's, I mean, if you want to talk about sort of like feminism done well, I think her character, just the screen prowess when she shares the screen with Gene Hackman, and who plays Little Bill, and they are, you know, she can stand toe to toe with him, you know, with this kind of authoritarian like sheriff. She has a fearlessness quality to her, and I think that, like you said, it's very believable, and just the performance is unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. Even, you know, all the little minor characters and things are just, you know, perfect actors for the roles. You know, obviously a huge name, but his part is relatively small in it. But Peter O'Toole is English Bob.
Oh, yeah.
Is just, you know, he's great. And I forget the name of the guy who plays.
Peter Beauchamp? O'Toole? Is he English Bob?
I think so.
I think it's Richard Harris.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Duh. Yeah, brain fart. Richard Harris, that's it. I was picturing in my head, too, but just threw out the wrong old English guy. So,
it's Richard Harris. And then, obviously, like you say, Morgan Freeman is Ned.
Yeah,
The best friend of Clint Eastwood, who's William Money.
Right. Yeah, and the actor... What's the character actor who plays Beauchamp, the writer? Saul Rubinek.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Great, great character actor. Does a great job as the writer who at first is accompanying English Bob until English Bob gets the shit kicked out of him by Little Bill. But
to me, Beauchamp is actually a very important character. And the meta kind of way that I view the film, he kind of is the audience. He is like the representation of the audience. And at first he has these very idealistic views of what the West should be and what the cowboy or the bounty hunter should be and what violence in the West should be. And his view is almost sort of like a naive love, the way that we like John Wayne movies or other Clint Eastwood movies or things like that. It's like this idealized version of the West. And he very quickly kind of gets an education of the reality of violence and the reality of who these characters are and the reality of how this system works. And it kind of changes his view. He goes through a little bit of a change, sort of like the audience does when they go from watching, you know, like a John Wayne film to something like this. But in the end, he does sort of get what he wants. You know, he does have that glimpse of all right, this is what I've been waiting for. And I think it's a commentary on the Western audience, which is like, yeah, we love sort of this deconstruction that Unforgiven is giving us. And it's very interesting to explore these realities and this kind of clunkiness, this clunky violence that it portrays. But we still do love these archetypes. We still do love the man with no name, you know? And so to me, he kind of represents like the evolution the viewer is supposed to be going through with viewing this as a little different than a contemporary Western, but still with a love of what brings you to the genre.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, everybody involved in making the film, I think really does love Westerns. And so, you know, to me, when you're doing a genre deconstructionist sort of a story, whether it's a film or a book or whatever, whoever's making the story or making the film has to love the genre that they're deconstructing. They have to really like know it and love it for it to work. Because when, like, you look at the way a lot of the wokeistas do deconstruction, they have contempt for what they're deconstructing, whether it's a genre or a character or a franchise or, you know, a cinematic universe or whatever. They typically have contempt for it, and it comes through in the film or in the show. And so it's just, to me, it's just not enjoyable, not watchable, not interesting in the way that something like Unforgiven is, where you can clearly tell everybody involved with making it loves Westerns and yet is still doing this, you know, revisionist deconstructionist take. And they're able to do it in a way that works. And that, like you were saying, fans of Westerns, and I am one and you are one, you know, I can appreciate even some of the, you know, like 50s Westerns, you know, and some of those are a little bit more, you know, morally ambiguous and complicated than others. But even the ones that are really simplistic, like, I can still appreciate them for what they are. And absolutely, yet I can also appreciate Unforgiven, and I can, you know, I can go back and forth between watching like a typical Western or watching something more revisionist if it's done well. But, you know, I can't watch some of the revisionist Westerns they do in more recent years, where they're shoving wokeism and all that stuff into it. And again, part of it's that I'm sick of woke ideology and never really liked it to begin with. And it's really, you know, getting old at this point. But also, I think that the people who make those sorts of deconstructions, they hate the genre that they're trying to reimagine.
Yeah. And look, to the point of loving Westerns, Tobe Hooper, who we both admire as a director and, you know, somebody who's involved in the horror industry, because people who have listened to us talk before know that we love horror films, especially classic horror films. And he had made a point in some interview that I saw or was watching about how closely related Westerns and horror films are, and how they give you the freedom, and they give the auteur the freedom to create these parables and experiment and tell different stories. Because a lot of people who would, you know, protest this in the industry or anything like this, you kind of write them off as just a genre film, you know, it doesn't have much important to say. Okay, you know, you're doing Cowboys and Indians or whatever. You know, so it's a Western film. Yeah, we'll get these actors or whatever. But then it gives you the freedom, because it's sort of written off as an unimportant non-drama piece, which it's quite the opposite. You know, it's very dramatic. But it gives the auteur the freedom to insert all these themes and do all these interesting things. And I love, whether it's the simplest of like John Wayne films to like a sort of like a neo noir kind of Western, like Dead Man with Johnny Depp, to, which I think is brilliant, to something like this, which I think is, you know, just a dramatic masterpiece. I love the entire genre. I think it's one of the best and most fun genres that can also mix in a lot of these interesting questions and insights, just like horror films.
Yeah, and it's arguably too like the most I don't know, the greatest American genre, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe second would be sort of like something that in some ways is closely related to it in storytelling and archetype sort of ways, but like the you know, hard boiled
noir crime genre.
Yeah,
absolutely. And those are great too. You know, those are great too. There is something. I think a lot of it has to do with our view and sort of Western society. We're very like protagonist driven as far as our love of the story, you know? So whether it's A Man with No Name in a Clint Eastwood Western, or it's a hard boiled detective, they share a lot of the same characteristics and a lot of the same motives and a lot of the same moral values. And we've talked about this before. I forget what conversation we had. We did a podcast where we were talking about a novel. We were talking about, we interviewed the author as well.
Santiago with
Santiago. Yeah.
By Mike Resnick.
That's right. And we were discussing this actual thing, like this, the qualities and the moral choices that the protagonists that American audiences tend to love. And I think William Money in this is a good example of that, but also again, a little bit of a deconstruction, right?
Yeah. Every little thing about it is, you know, turning typical Western tropes on its head, right? Down to things like Clint Eastwood, you know, William Money, he keeps getting thrown off his horse. Like he can't even, you know, he can't even seem to ride his horse properly, but it's not done in like a way where it's, you know, for yucks or whatever. It's like, no, this is realistic. This guy has a horse who kind of sucks, you know? And the first time we see him, he's like literally covered in pig shit. You know, he's not like riding into town looking all sporty in a cool Western outfit, you know, looking like the badass alpha gunfighter. You know, he's like literally rolling in shit because he's trying to deal with sick pigs or whatever. So, and then of course we get Schofield Kid, who I forget the name of that actor. I don't think he's been in too much that I can think of. But again, he's great in that role, you know, where he's
James Woolvett is
okay. Name. I can't remember. I'm sure he's been in other stuff, but I can't recall off the top of my head what else he might have been in.
He was in. I think he was in. There's another kind of. He was in Dead Presidents. I can't remember what else he was in, but there is a few. There's one that's on the back of my mind, but I'm sure I'll remember in 5 minutes when we're on to a different topic. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's just so great as, you know, this young, hot-headed kid with a big mouth and whatever. And I love the arc he goes through, where, you know, he starts off, he's all aggressive, he's a hothead, he's even, you know, talking shit to Will and Ned, bragging about how many men he's killed and whatever. And then, I mean, you know, first off, we find out he can't see for shit.
Isn't that interesting that, like, what is his problem? What is
exactly
the handicap that they give him is that he can't see, right? And that, again, this is not an arbitrary choice. It's that he cannot see this world for what it really is. This is another kind of nod to the audience. You know, he represents the idealistic. I want to be a fast gunslinger and I want to be a bounty hunter and all this stuff, but he can't see things for what they actually are until he can, right? Later in the film.
Yeah. I mean, when he finally does kill someone, it's such a great scene, that scene in the aftermath of that, where, you know, he's talking to Will and they have that. I mean, the dialogue in this movie is just so, so well done.
Yeah.
where he's talking about, and he finally comes clean and admits he's never killed anyone before. And, you know, you can just really see him. He's sort of going back and forth. He's like, well, they had it coming, but then he's, you know, he's kind of going back and forth, like in real time in front of you over like how he feels about it. On the one hand, he's trying to play it off like, oh, you know, those guys deserve it, whatever. At the same time, like, he's clearly disturbed by it. And I just love the arc that he goes through when he eventually just, you know, hands Clint Eastwood his gun and says, I don't want it anymore.
Yeah, he doesn't want to see. He says he doesn't care about the glasses anymore, because one of the reasons he's joining them is so he can get money for fancy clothes or fancy or some new glasses and things like this. And he says, you know, he's like, at the end, he's like, I don't want the money. I don't care about the glasses or anything like that anymore. After he does get a glimpse of what the reality of killing another human being is, he says, I want to return to my blindness, you know, basically. And I think that that's an extremely powerful message, and probably I think the most explicit message in the film is and there's a scene I want to talk about as far as this theme is, which is the true nature of violence versus the Hollywood version of violence, which I think is one of the meta deconstructions in the film. And Little Bill talks a little bit about it in the jail to the audience, to Mr. Beauchamp, right? When he's talking about how you have to take your time when you're in a gunfight, and you have to, that being fast is no, he says it doesn't hurt any, right, to be fast. But it's no measure for being able to take your time and having cold blood and an iron will and the ability to hold steady and aim and take out your target. And it's a very polarizing view compared to what the traditional Western has you believe, which is you quick draw, shoot from the hip, great music, you know, triumphant music is playing, you jump on your horse. And all the violence in this film is very different than that. It's very realistic. It's extremely brutal. Even the scene when the cowboy is slowly dying and they let him take a drink and stuff like that after they shoot him. I'm sure you'll talk a little bit about that. But to me, this is the central theme of the film, which is what violence really is compared to what it is traditionally displayed as in a rubber stamp Western.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of those older Westerns, they don't even show blood, you know, like people get shot in the chest with a rifle and like, there's no blood, you know, and they yeah. just sort of like keel over nice and neat, you know?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate any movie that depicts violence in a realistic fashion, whether it's, you know, gunfights or whether it's, you know, hand to hand or whatever, even when it's disturbing. And it's not primarily like that I'm some sort of sadist or whatever. It's a more complicated sort of feeling, but, you know, war movies that depict war realistically, movies that depict, you know, physical hand to hand fights in a realistic fashion, I don't know. I always appreciate it. You know, when you see like a fight scene in a movie that is like a fight that you would actually see on the street.
Yeah.
That it's chaotic. It's ugly. It's messy. It's undignified. I mean, that was one of those things that like the world finally started to realize when things like the UFC became popular is like, And that's not even anywhere near, you know, the chaos and ugliness of a street fight. That's still in a controlled environment with only two opponents. Sure, yeah. And no weapons or whatever. And there's a ref to stop it if it gets too bad or whatever. But even so, you look at that and, you know, people who didn't understand real fighting were like, well, it looks like those two guys are just gay. They're in there just, you know, rubbing on each other. It's like, yeah, have you ever actually seen what most, you know, street fights and bar fights actually turn into? There's usually not a whole lot of punches and kicks thrown until they're, you know, scrambling around on the ground and whatever like that. But yeah, I don't know. I just have always really appreciated that, And I have a hard time with so many Hollywood movies that, you know, are action movies when it's just so ridiculously unrealistic. You know, so I mean, sometimes it makes sense, like in the Matrix or whatever. Obviously, it makes sense to have these crazy, you know, Matrixy fight scenes because it makes sense in story, right? But when it's supposed to be like a real fight in the real world and it looks like, you know, Matrix mixed with ballet or something like that, it's so tensionless and whatever. Whereas, like, you see, you know, I think about, like, for example, in The Sopranos when Tony Soprano kills what's his name, that guy who was in The Fugitive, the fight they get, it's brutal. When they fight and eventually Tony manages to kill him.
It's not, and this is, I think I had mentioned to you when we were emailing and talking about doing this podcast, talking about the Unforgiven, that, and this is kind of a tangent I don't want to go off on because it's such a huge topic in itself, but this, I think this was very much like a David Lynch idea with the TV series Twin Peaks. It's really, even though it's like a kind of a quirky old series and a lot of people, that's the way they would describe this, quirky and weird, but the violence in it and the subject matter in it is just gut-wrenching. They would never show anything like that on network TV now, like the kind of the themes or the amount of violence that they showed with certain scenes there. And I think that was very much in his mind during a time when other TV shows did kind of have this attitude towards violence where characters were just sort of easily dispensable for the sake of the story, or, you know, it was easy to kill someone, you know, like kind of like it is in a movie, you know, what's a great Western where you could probably view violence a little different. It would be like Tombstone. All right. That's one where, the life of a supporting character isn't quite as valuable. You know, when you're watching that movie, you have a lot of kind of throwaway characters. It's a great movie and I love it. And it's so quotable, but it's a completely different animal than something like this, where it really is not going to shield you from the pornography of violence. Like it wants it to hit you in the face a little bit and realize the kind of hellish atmosphere that these characters were living in.
Yeah, sort of a random thing, but I just remembered something that I hadn't noticed about Unforgiven until I was reading some stuff online about it, and I came across this, that there's certain elements of the story that are somewhat based on the Iliad. Which I'm usually pretty good at spotting when things from Homer or things from Shakespeare or biblical stories or whatever are, you know, partially mixed in with I right away spotted that Sons of Anarchy was very, you know, based on the story structure of Hamlet. Like I saw that for what it was, like the first episode, you know, before people started, you know, talking about it and whatever. I'm usually pretty good at that kind of thing. You know, when a story has elements of the Odyssey or the elements of, you know, some Shakespeare story or whatever. But I hadn't realized that there are certain aspects of the Iliad in Unforgiven. Now, obviously, not a ton. It's, you know, it's a Western. It's not a war movie. But and I forget all the ones that I think it was even on the Wikipedia page for Unforgiven. But things like, for example, in the Iliad, there's the part where Achilles doesn't want to fight and he's like staying in camp and refusing to go. And he doesn't until he finds out that his, what was it? His cousin or his best friend or whatever. I forget the character's name. Was it something like a Greek version of Patrick or something, I think.
Patrocles.
Yeah, there we go. That, you know, he had gone out there in Achilles armor and then got killed by Hector. And that, you know, that's very similar structurally to what happens when Ned gets killed by little Bill. And then, you know, Will Money picks up the bottle for the first time in the entire movie. He picks up the bottle, and then that's when you realize, like, oh, shit's going to go down. There were some other ways that structurally there were some, you know, Iliad type elements in Unforgiven. But what it made me think of, and I've been meaning to reread the Iliad. It's probably been close to 20 years since I read it last. But one of the things I remember from the Iliad, and I actually, we read the Iliad and talked about it in, of all things, a political thought class that I took at Flagler College. Really, really good, a political science professor who's still there, named Arthur Vandenhouten. And he does political thought. Back then, he did Intro to Political Thought in two parts. And some of it's stuff you would expect, like, you know, you read Aristotle in Plato's Republic, and, you know, later on you eventually get to like Machiavelli and some of these other like Enlightenment era guys. But in the first half, I think, is like ancient, and then the second half is modern, and I forget if medieval was put into part one or part two. But, you know, we read Aquinas, we even read Luther and Calvin, some of the stuff they wrote that had political implications. But some of the stuff that we read are things that you might not normally think of that you'd be reading in an Intro to Political Thought class. And one of them was the Iliad.
Hmm.
And one of the things that I remember, and he runs very good discussion seminar. Most of his classes are discussion seminars, even like the intro classes. He runs his discussion seminars, very unusual for an undergrad professor. But one of the things I remember, the class I was in discussing a lot about the Iliad, was the way that violence is depicted in the Iliad changes over the course of the story, where I think earlier in the book, the violence is depicted more kind of like romantically, more kind of like sexy or whatever like that. It's sort of more stylized, more like a typical Hollywood action movie. And then as the story goes on, the violence gets uglier, like right on down to the word choices by Homer and the imagery and things like this, it's sort of like, again, you're taking the reader on a journey of, you know, you start off with the violence being somewhat sanitized and stylized and everything like that. And then you get disabused of those fantasies. Right. As the story goes on, the violence gets more ugly and in a way more realistic. So,
yeah, anyway. I mean, that's the central theme. And it's interesting that it is tied in. That's an interesting tie-in with the Iliad. And I really haven't thought about that either. I think there's a few scenes that specifically depict what we're talking about here. And I would say the first one that really, really shows it well is when they shoot the cowboy. I think it's Will Money that ends up shooting him. And they kind of show the agony, this kind of the slow death of the cowboy. And they let him take a drink of water. They say, "We're not going to shoot you. You can go get some water." And you hear him sort of crying out because they shoot him with a rifle from a little bit of a distance.
Yeah, Ned shoots him and just like hits him in the gut or something.
Right, right. Is it Ned?
Yeah, Ned makes the first shot, but then he's disturbed. And
he gives the gun to Will Money.
Yeah, yeah. He's you know, not willing, not able to finish him off. So... yeah, and actually, in the little making of that I was watching this morning, Morgan Freeman said that in his mind, he thought of Ned as a character, like in terms of, you know, as good actors should, like he put a lot of thought into, you know, Ned's potential backstory and all that sort of stuff. And he said that in his mind, he always thought of Ned as not really being like the real killer, that he's basically the guy who watches Will's back, like back when they were younger and, you know, being outlaws and gunfighters and whatever, that Ned wasn't really the killer. He's just the friend and the back watcher. And Will was like the real killer. So
yeah, and then you also get allusions to this theme where when there's a scene where Will Money, where Clint Eastwood is talking about some of the things he had done in the past about, and you know, he's like, that guy didn't deserve that. He talks about shooting a guy in the face, I think, at close range. Then you have this scene in the jail that we talked about where Little Bill is describing what a gunfight is actually like to Mr. Beauchamp, and that it's funny that Mr. Beauchamp was sort of like writing comics or these sort of like dime store kind of stories. And that's what his view of the West is. And Gene Hackman kind of cures him of that. Then you obviously get the ending, you know, which is got some great lines in it. And it's a very slow and shows kind of the goofy clunkiness of real violence with the gunfight in the saloon. And then you get the very dramatic up close and personal dispatching of Little Bill by Will Money in a way that, like you said, it's after he picks up the bottle. It's after, you know, all this sort of character arc is kind of almost complete at the end up into the epilogue, which I think is the end, quite literally, of the character arc. And we'll talk a little bit about that later, I'm sure, because that's, I think, a different theme is Will's arc. But those three or four scenes in particular are very focused around what violence is more like, really. You know, of course, it's still a film, it's still a movie, there's still elements of act, you know, dramatization. But even Mr. Beauchamp, after Will Money takes out all these people in the saloon, you know, like four or five gunfighters or whatever it is, he even says, he comes up to him and he tries to analyze it, right? He's like, oh, I've read that a superior gunfighter will always take out the best enemy first and then whatever. And then Will Money's like, no, I've always been lucky in my killing. You know, he's like, I can't tell you who was first. All I can tell you is who's going to be last. And then Mr. Beauchamp gets out of there, you know, kind of a warning to him, you know, like, listen, I'm not here for the glory. I'm not here to talk about it. I'm here to kill and take revenge for the killing of my friend Ned. And as he even says that explicitly, he's like, you know, I'm here to kill you, Little Bill, because you killed my friend Ned, you know, and that's what it's about to him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love pretty much every scene in this movie, but yeah, that, the climax there, you know, the only real gunfight in the whole thing. Cause I mean, even when they shoot the one cowboy, it's done at long range with a rifle and, you know, it's not really like a gunfight per se.
It's an assassination of sorts. Like, and that's what Gene Hackman even calls Will Money or Little Bill even calls what he calls him an assassin.
Right.
And that's how he refers to them. Because I think that's very true to what the bounty hunter probably was, right? They weren't the type of person that was going to unnecessarily put themselves in harm's way and say, hey, let's go out in the street and have a duel. I'm here to get the reward. It was like if I can kill you and get the bounty without putting myself in extreme danger, well, that's the smart thing to do. So it wasn't, though we love this idealized version of the bounty hunter, right? Like that's sort of, there's probably a little less nobility in it than portrayed in certain films. And this film shows that through the way Little Bill talks about assassins, his hatred of bounty hunters, and kind of the way the film gives you the backstory without really showing you of the real kind of son of a bitch that Will Money was. You know, like he talks about it himself. He makes no allusions to the fact that he was a rotten, terrible, evil human being as an assassin or as a bounty hunter. And that it was only his wife who's passed away in the film that cured him of that, cured him of his drinking, cured him of, you know, his philanderous ways and his killing people and all this stuff and made an honest man out of him. It was only love that did that. But the opposite of that is everything that he was before.
Yeah, and that comes out again after Ned gets killed. I always loved the line when Will Money walks into the saloon at the climax, and the first thing he does is he kills the saloon keeper, which is interesting. And he kills him, and then I love Little Bill says, you know, calls him a coward or whatever, and says, "You just shot an unarmed man." And I love the response. He should have armed himself. You know, even when I was a kid and I first saw that, like that line, I was like, you know, there's just something about it where, you know, and then he says, you know, he should have armed himself if he wants to decorate his saloon with my friend.
Because they've got Ned out front in the coffin as a warning to other bounty hunters who might be coming for the reward that the prostitutes have put up. And my favorite line from the film is in the same scene, is the very end, is the last thing he says. And I repeat it around the house all the time. Like, it's funny if we're complaining about something or my wife says something like, "Oh, you don't deserve that." I say, "Deserve ain't got nothing to do with it."
Yep. That's my favorite line in the film too, actually. And
it's such a great one.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and it ties into the whole theme of the reality of violence and also just the reality of life, you know, because wonderful people, you know, get killed in tragic circumstances, and assholes live to be 100 sometimes. And, you know, a certain amount of it is just chaos and statistics.
Yeah.
Even outside the realm of violence, you know, I mean, good people who didn't do anything to bring it on still get cancer, you know. It's not just people like who smoke and get lung cancer. You could say, well, you know, maybe they don't deserve that, but at least they kind of did to some degree bring it on themselves. But then there's people who, you know, live a fairly healthy life and whatever, and just randomly get cancer somewhere, and that's it. People, you know, just driving down the street and a cement truck crosses the yellow line, and that's it. Deserves got nothing to do with it.
Even in that scene, it's so clumsy, all the gunfighting. It's very slow for a fast gunfight. People are missing. They're panicking. All these people who are ready. There's like the one character who has like all kinds of guns that he says, he says something earlier in the film, like, "I don't want to get killed for lack of shooting back. Right.
He's the one-armed character too. And he's got, he has extra guns, and yeah, I think the other deputy is like, "You only got one arm. How come you got, you know, extra guns?" And he says, "Yeah, I don't want to get killed for lack of shooting back."
But it's funny how, like, then later on, like, it's very much what Little Bill was describing in the jail scene with Mr. Beauchamp. He was, you know, Will Money was being calculated and careful and sort of taking his time with his killing. And the other guys, no matter how many guns they prepared themselves with, right, they were panicking. They weren't really ready to face that reality of, you know, life and death. And it was sort of Will Money's lack of morality and the fact that he was sort of almost like a machine in that way, where life and death meant nothing to him at that point, you know, because deserve ain't got nothing to do with it. You know, there was no morality clouding his ability to do the killing. There were no nerves. There was nothing like that you see in characters like the Schofield kid, or that you see in these other small characters that were associated with Little Bill that were helping him in the saloon. And the only other real takeaway from that scene that I had, going back to the horrors of the prostitutes, was kind of like they wanted to shield their eyes from it, right? When he came into the saloon, where they had all been kind of upstairs watching Little Bill give this big speech about how they're going to go find all the assassins and they're going to take them out. And they're going to hunt down Will Money, because they thought he was gone after they killed Ned. They thought he was running away and he was going out of town. and they didn't expect him to be coming back into town to take care of business. So they were kind of watching and just listening to all this going on downstairs in the saloon. But as soon as they saw Clint Eastwood come in, as soon as they saw Will Money come in, they knew that, almost like he was the Grim Reaper, right? They knew death was there. So they left. They didn't want to see it, except, you know, I think one of them kind of stayed and kind of watched through her hands, you know, peeking through her fingers or something like this. But I thought that was a very interesting dynamic to show the reality of violence, how clumsy it was, but also how final it was. You know, Gene Hackman says, Little Bill says, "I was building a house." You know, that's the last thing he says, which is kind of there's a bit of a gag in the movie. He wasn't doing a very good job building the house because it was leaking during a rainstorm. But he's like, that's when he said, "I don't deserve this." You know, he was like, he felt like he was a good man. He felt like he was doing the right things. He felt like he was a servant of the law. He had this thing left to accomplish that he wanted to finish building his house, and he felt like he didn't deserve it. So even he had a sort of idealized view of the moralities of the West and violence. And it was only Will Money that really understood what it was, because he was the killer. And he says, "Hey, you know, deserve ain't got nothing to do with it. Your life isn't any more protected than, you know, the cowboys that we shot earlier, or mine, or Ned's, or anyone else's."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, and you know, one more thing that I always appreciated about that climactic confrontation there is that, and it's another illustration of like the chaos and randomness of violence, where after Eastwood takes out the saloon keeper, he's got a double barrel shotgun when he walks in, and you know, he fires one barrel into the saloon keeper. And then, you know, he talks a little bit with Little Bill, but he's pointing the shotgun at Little Bill. And then he initially, you know, tries to take out Little Bill with the other barrel of the shotgun, and there's a misfire. And of course, that's when Little Bill says, "Kill the son of a bitch." But, you know, A, the fact that, yeah, misfires could happen, especially with, you know, the sorts of gunpowder of back then. And then the fact that when the gun misfires, Will Money improvises very quickly, which, you know, people who are successful in fights, whether they're gunfights or hand to hand, usually a big part of it is just the ability to improvise faster than the other guy, the ability to respond to the situation faster than the other guy. And he throws the shotgun. This is like the cliche of like old Superman shows, right? Where the bank robber empties his revolver into Superman and then throws the gun at him. You're like, come on, the bullets didn't hurt him, but if you just chuck your revolver, it's gonna take him out. But you know, in this case, it actually makes sense. It's actually like the smartest thing he could have done there. And he throws the shotgun at Little Bill and ducks as he does. He throws and ducks, and then, you know, pulls out his six gun. And so Little Bill misses him because A, the shotgun is getting thrown at him, and B, you know, Will Money is like ducking as he's throwing the shotgun. And I don't know, just that little detail is the sort of thing I appreciate in a realistic fight scene, where it's like, yeah, it's chaotic. You know, things go wrong. They don't go according to plan. Very often the person who wins is just the person that reacts quicker to the changing situation. But, you know, it always makes me think of the old Mike Tyson line, "Everyone's got a plan going into a fight till they get punched in the face." So
yeah.
I don't know, just that little detail of the shotgun misfires and then he responds by throwing it instead. That just always stuck out to me even when I was a kid watching this. I was like, oh, that seems like something that might actually happen in real life, you know.
What do you make of the treatment, or I guess the difference between the character of English Bob and Little Bill? Because Mr. Beauchamp, as we talked about before, is with English Bob and kind of he's there to kind of be his biographer in a way. He's writing all these stories about him because he is the quintessential deadeye, quick draw gunfighter. He kind of represents that version of the Old West or the bounty hunter or whatever. And Little Bill takes care, like he beats the crap out of English Bob and then kind of turns Mr. Beauchamp against him. And then Mr. Beauchamp starts being more buddy-buddy with Little Bill instead of English Bob. I have a few different ways of looking at that, but it is interesting that this more Hollywood version of the basic gunfighter gets beat up by this Little Bill character, who's kind of the messenger of what violence really is and how the West really works. And then he's just sort of kicked out of town and he kind of disappears from the film altogether. He doesn't come back into the picture at all. So I kind of view it in that meta way of like, hey, this is a film about real violence and I'm kicking out this version of fake violence of the story. But that might be a bridge too far, but that's sort of how I viewed the reason English Bob is in there.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. It's just another way that they could, in a good way, subvert your expectations, right? And deconstruct things. And, you know, throughout the film, there's just constant, you know, of taking a Western trope and then putting it on its head, right? I mean, that definitely is part of it, or an example of it. Another is even just Little Bill himself. When you watch this movie for the first time, I think a lot of people would assume, and maybe not if they, you know, saw that Clint Eastwood's name was first in the list of actors or whatever, but I think a lot of people, if they were just going into this movie blank slate, knew nothing about it, and started to watch it, I think in the first few scenes, they would assume that Little Bill is going to be the protagonist because he's the sort of character that in, you know, most Westerns, it's the sheriff, right? It's the marshal, right, whatever, who is the protagonist. And, you know, at least initially, he seems like a quote unquote good guy. Now, eventually, or pretty quickly, you realize he's not, but anyway, I just think that that's another example too, is just the introduction of him and then how he's kind of spun. And yet at the same time, like, you know, another great thing about this movie that's missing from so many recent movies is the degree of ambiguity. Like there really are no good guys other than maybe Ned. And even he does shoot the young cowboy, but right. You know, I mean, Will Money is not a good guy, but Little Bill certainly isn't either. Everybody, well,
even the prostitutes aren't 100%. Granted, they're justified, I would argue, in their offering of the $1,000 bounty. But there's an interesting dialogue between Alice and Little Bill where he says, "Do you realize what offering this bounty is going to do? It's not going to bring anything but violence and destruction of this town," kind of thing. So even they are not above reproach for kind of the invitation of violence. He's like, is this what you want? You want more death? Now I have a bit more sympathy towards their plight. But I do, there are scenes that really make you question, is Little Bill a bad guy? That's a great question on its face. I mean, he's just a guy, kind of, who happens to be a sheriff, who has some interesting qualities that you might think are good qualities. And definitely there's some bad stuff in there too. But he's just sort of a product more than he is a story driver. He's kind of a product of the situation and of the time. I think he does want like a peaceful town. And I don't think he wants to rule as some sort of tyrant. I don't really view him as that kind of a character. But he is the antagonist. I mean, he is kind of like the bad guy in a way.
It is very ambiguous. A way that the cowboys certainly are not. Right. You know, the cowboys are not any sort of a threat to, you know, our trio of bounty hunters. And Little Bill, interestingly, he's a gun controller, so that's kind of interesting considering, you know, Eastwood's conservatarian leanings that the antagonist is, among other things, a gun control, as much of a gun controller as you can be in the context of the American Old West. And to me, what's interesting about one of the interesting things about Little Bill is he is a figure who seems to prize order over justice. He wants order, not justice.
Correct. That's very good way to describe him. Yeah, I like that.
And you see it right off the bat where, you know, the way he deals with the cowboy who cut up the prostitute, he initially is going to whip him, and then he doesn't, and then he simply, you know, orders them to compensate the owner of the whorehouse and saloon with horses. So like it's more of like the kind of justice that, like, I don't know, ancient Germanic tribes would have, like where if you murdered somebody, you could potentially just like pay off their relatives, you know, and that would be that. And it was more about just trying to keep things orderly and prevent, you know, things from escalating and getting out of hand. Like that's what ultimately what Little Bill, his number one priority is order. And that's why he doesn't like, you know, the idea of bounty hunters coming in and trying to, you know, take the law into their own hands in a way. And a very interesting thing that I caught on the making of featurette that I watched this morning, Gene Hackman said that Clint Eastwood told him to base the character of Little Bill, his portrayal of Little Bill, on a real life hardcore chief of police. And that was a guy named Daryl Gates, who I had heard of in books like Rise of the Warrior Cop by Radley Balco. Daryl Gates was the LA chief of police for, like, I think most of the second half of the 20th century, practically. And he was the guy who turned the LA Police Department into what we think of in terms of, like, you know, the department that brings you the Rodney King beating and all that stuff. And he was the guy who presided over, really, it was the first, as far as I know, the first big militarization of an American non-federal law enforcement agency was the real beginning, like starting in the Vietnam era of militarizing American law enforcement. Daryl Gates was like the guy. He's the guy who presided over militarizing the LA Police Department, creating the first modern SWAT team, and just in general inculcating that, like, really over the top, excessive style of policing that we often associate with LA cops, particularly in the late 20th century. And so I thought that was just absolutely fascinating. A, that at least in part, that's, you know, what the character of Little Bill was based on. And I don't know, I don't think Peoples himself said anything one way or the other of that. So I don't know if David Peoples was thinking of that when he wrote it. But Eastwood as the director certainly was, because he told Gene Hackman, yeah, here's a real life guy that you can look at for, like, what Little Bill is supposed to be. He's just like an overzealous law and order, you know, extremist, a police extremist.
Wow. That's definitely, I can see that now that you're saying that, especially with the points you were talking about with the, you know, order over justice kind of thing. That's very interesting. That's the perfect way to describe him, really, is, you know, order trumps justice, because even in the conversation he has with Alice, where she's like, this isn't fair, when he first says, okay, well, you're just gonna have to pay the bar owner or whatever, because technically the prostitute that was cut up was his property or whatever. She's like, this isn't fair. That's not justice. And he is very unconcerned with that. He's like, no, we just need to get things back under control here. If I have a bunch of, you know, bounty hunters coming in, things are going to get out of control. Very interesting. But there's two other kind of very American loves and themes that this, I think, the film addresses. So we've got violence, which we love as Americans. Then there's also alcohol and sex. Those are kind of like our three favorite things. And this addresses all of them. So what do you think? Do you have anything in particular to say about the way sex is portrayed in the film? Or maybe how different characters view it? Or the statement that the film might be making in regards to that or anything like that?
Well, I mean, the main thing that I think that the film is doing or portraying in regard to sex is very similar to what they're doing with violence, which is it's portrayed in a very, you know, unglamorous, earthy, for lack of a better term, sort of a way. You know, it's also like with the violence, it is not sanitized, stylized Hollywood, you know, when it's actually depicted or when characters are talking about it. It's done in a very unromanticized way. But other than that, I don't know. What's your take?
Well, I mean, it's very transactionary. Obviously, you're dealing with prostitution, right? Which are the females in the film, other than one very quick part where you meet Ned's wife, who's Native American, very, very quickly, because she's going to take care of Will Money's kids. She does not have a big part in the film. But other than her, everyone is a prostitute. That's a female in the film, I think without exception. And that obviously doesn't include Will Money's wife, who you only see in writing in the epilogue or prologue or when he's referencing her, but you never see it. There's not a character that plays the part. So you have sort of the transactionary nature of it on one aspect. Other than one little glimpse of it, there's a scene where, or a series of scenes when the bounty hunters arrive, when Ned, Will Money, and the Scofield kid arrive, they start to take advances on the money, at least Ned and the Scofield kid do, by sleeping with the prostitutes, you know? So I think Ned says, hey, they're willing to, you know, sleep with us if, you know, we'll take some advances on the money for whatever. And the only one who kind of abstains from it, if I recall correctly, is Will Money. He says no. He can't sort of defile his oath to his wife, who he loved, probably the only person he ever loved. He can't do that. He can't bring himself to do that. He's uninterested with it. The only thing he's interested in is getting this job done, getting these cowboys, and getting out of town, getting back to his two children, and getting the reward money. That's sort of his motivation. Is that so? He's very, other than this one scene, there is a scene where the prostitute who has been cut in the face, who kind of is the reason that this all started, she has a really touching scene with where it's just the two of them. It's just Will Money and the prostitute, and she's telling him how they're taking advances on the money by sleeping with the prostitutes, and he doesn't seem to care much. But she kind of offers herself to him in a way. And she's like, you know, it wouldn't be like for money or anything, just if you want to, you know. She's like, I know I'm ugly, because, and she's actually a very pretty woman, but she does have the scar on her face. And she's like, I know nobody wants to sleep with somebody who's cut up or something like this. And he says, no, that's not the reason, you know, I don't want to sleep with you. It's not, you know, anything to do with you, you know, it's to do with me. And I think that it's what it's kind of trying to drive at is the one kind of redeeming characteristic of Will Money is his loyalty and the memory of his wife. I think that's a big, big part of the film, especially considering you never meet that character of his wife, but sort of his dedication to his family, which is his wife who has passed away and his children who he's trying to get this reward money for to give them a better life, trumps everything else. And it drives him into picking up this past that he has long since been cured of and tried to avoid being this terrible person. But in a way, it's his wife and the memory of her that gets him out of that life, but also which plunges him back into it. And his abstinence from, you know, sleeping with the prostitute or taking advances on the money or whatever is kind of one of his endearing qualities. And it kind of does show that one of the best things about him is his loyalty. You know, his loyalty to Ned, obviously, as a friend, but more so the loyalty to his family and to his wife. So I think that it's getting somewhere with that. I think it's used, sex is kind of used as a mechanism to show, juxtaposed to his loyalty, the fact that he won't engage in it and that the others will. And they're not bad guys. You know, they're not, you know, Ned or the Schofield kid, you definitely couldn't characterize them as the bad guy, but they are sleeping with the prostitutes and taking advances on the money in that way, where he refuses to do so, though he is regarded as the most vicious of the three.
Yeah, that's interesting. And even Ned, right, is getting freebies as advances, and his wife is still alive. We met her near the beginning of the film. So yeah, that makes him, you know, he's a better person when it comes to killing people, but he's not the better man when it comes to loyalty to his wife.
And he's the only character who regards the whores as anything other than property. Like he, in that scene, which is very deliberate. It's very touching scene. And there is kind of almost some romantic friction between the two. You can tell that she kind of views him in sort of a heroic fashion because he's there to kind of avenge the fact that she was cut up and there was no justice and stuff like that. So I do feel like she feels like almost like a responsibility to offer herself to him, or some sort of attraction there. Like, here's this strong man who has come to, you know, fight for my honor. But the reality is that that's not the case, right? The reality is that he is there because of his sort of familial obligations. And though there's a temptation there on his part, he does refuse it. And they wouldn't include that little scene, I don't think, unless they were trying to make a very deliberate point about his character arc and sort of the temptation that sex has for the other characters that they all fall victim to. And in fact, again, it's part of what starts this whole story off, is like a sexual joke or episode. And the fact that, I guess, some of the protagonists of the film are the prostitutes themselves, you know, because they're trying to get their justice, and the film makes no bones about how brutal their life is and how terrible that position in life to be, you know, a prostitute is not a glamorous thing, you know? So it's very interesting. And though it's a smaller part than the violence I think is the main theme, as we talked about earlier. I do think that it's in there for a reason, some of these, you know, sexual themes or very small scenes in the movie.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Peoples is obviously a very good writer, unlike a lot of the hacks or most of the hacks that are running things today. So, you know, you watch a lot of recently done films and TV shows, and there's things that'll be inserted in there, and you're like, I don't even know, like things that are set up and never paid off and whatever, and not even done in like a subversive sort of like I meant to do that kind of way, but like you could just tell, like, oh yeah, the screenwriter forgot they set this thing up earlier in the first act and they never paid it off or whatever. But you know, with somebody like Peoples, like, he obviously knows his craft, right? And so I think you're right that, like, there's no things that are accidental or random as far as scenes and dialogue and all that sort of thing.
I think it's just meant to show the kind of like the rewarding characteristic is his like faithfulness. Is that what I would say?
Yeah. And that's one of the very few things that makes him a sympathetic character in the whole movie, you know, because he's pretty unlikable in a lot of ways. You know, I mean, he's occasionally funny, you know, in like his dry sense of humor. But, you know, he's fallen off his horse. He's grumpy. You know, he's sick for a while there. Like, he's not super likable in the conventional sense. Right. But that's one of the things about him, though, that does make him sympathetic is his loyalty to his wife, which he also shows not just by, you know, abstaining from the prostitutes, but he also shows loyalty to his wife for most of the movie by abstaining from alcohol, which again, you know, his compatriots are having drinks and whatever, and he's not. And even when he's, you know, ill, of course, back then, one of the few things that people would do when they got a fever or whatever is drink liquor. And he stays away from it. And so he never breaks his abstinence from sex, although he finally does break his abstinence from booze.
Yeah. It's when
which is interesting.
He learns that Ned has been killed and put up in front of the saloon. One of the prostitutes comes to tell him that. And give him the money for killing the cowboys. And that's when he's kind of so enraged, though he's quietly enraged, he takes the alcohol and he starts to drink it. And you can see that switch flicking, those wheels start to turn, where he starts to turn back into that person that, you know, he claims his wife had cured him of being. You know, so the alcohol is very much a switch, I think. You see his character change. He becomes very different after he takes that drink of alcohol. He becomes a different character. Now, I think the backbone of the character is the same in certain aspects, but it enables him to become the old Will Money. And he, in fact, says it when he walks in again in this epic last scene we've talked about several times. He says, yeah, I'm Will Money. I'm the guy who's killed women and children, and I'm here to kill you, Little Bill. He's very unapologetic after he starts to drink the alcohol of the things that he's done in the past, where he's very regretful and kind of running from his past and the rest of the film. Whenever he talks about his past, he talks about it with a very much of a self-hatred and a self-loathing. But after he drinks the alcohol, he almost kind of embraces it, needfully so, because he's got to go do a very, you know, he's got to go kill a bunch of people at this saloon. But that is what enables him to do it. And I think that is also an interesting kind of theme there, even though it's lightly touched upon.
Yeah. It does, you know, kind of come up throughout the film. Like every time he, you know, very, very noticeably declines any booze. And yeah, just there's just so much nuance and subtlety and ambiguity throughout, you know, all aspects of this film in a way that you just almost never in films and things made in the last 5-6 years see that degree of subtlety. Everything is like this very, you know, ham-fisted, on the nose, you know, blatant, here's the good guys and here's the bad guys. And of course, you know, the bad guys are always evil, white, straight men or whatever. You know,
well, the alcohol is what he gives the Schofield kid after the Schofield kid kills the second cowboy and has this kind of awakening that we talk about of what violence really is and doesn't want to see it anymore. Will gives him the liquor, right? And that's how he kind of deals with it, is he starts drinking the alcohol in that scene. And he's taking big swigs out of this bottle and he's describing, he's like, you know, I killed him and one minute he's alive and one minute he's not. And then Will Money says, that's the thing about killing a man. You take away all he's got and all he's ever going to have. Another great line about the finality of violence and the truth of violence. And the only thing that can help the Schofield kid kind of medicate himself through this thing that he's just done and embrace this kind of new person he's become after being someone who's now killed somebody is the alcohol. And I don't think it's an accident that the town that all this takes place in is called Big Whiskey either.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, they could have named it anything. I mean, it sounds like a very believable name. Maybe there even was a town called, but I don't know, but I think that's interesting. And again, going back to the writing prowess, you know, of somebody like Peoples, none of this, I don't think is by accident.
Yeah. One other thing that I wanted to mention too, that, you know, again, is such skillful subversion of expectations and illustrating this moral ambiguity and the whole theme of, you know, deserves got nothing to do with it. It is the the character of Davy, the kind of younger of the two cowboys that are, you know, have the bounty on them. Davy is portrayed very sympathetically. I mean,
oh yeah,
he not only did he not hurt the prostitute, like he was just there with his buddy, you know, banging a different prostitute when the opening incident happens. But I think he might have even sort of tried to at least somewhat restrain the other cowboy, the one who was cutting up the prostitute. And he was much more like apologetic almost. And
yeah, he was.
He was
a victim of circumstance for sure.
Yeah. And you know, he brought in extra ponies of his own to give to the prostitute, not to the guy running the whorehouse. You know, he brought in extra ponies specifically to give to her. Like he was actually trying. Now, of course, you know, the kind of head prostitute.
Alice.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Alice. I couldn't remember the character's name. Yeah. She, you know, just stays pissed off and whatever, as if it's, you know, just a token gesture. But, you know, it seems like he was genuinely with what he had. He was trying to do some sort of justice, you know, and directly right. compensate the woman, even though he's not the one who hurt her. He's not the one who cut her up. And, you know, the bounty goes on him, even though, as well as the guy who actually did it. And, you know, he ends up being the first one getting killed is the guy who's maybe in a way, one of the most innocent characters in the movie, really.
Yeah.
We never see Davy. I don't think he ever hurts anybody in the movie. He never kills anybody. And he dies probably other than Ned, the worst death in the film.
Yeah.
You know, he dies after suffering with a gut shot, you know, when he's screaming and thirsty and whatever. And again,
it's
so just
childlike and like, it's almost like a child crying when he's dying. Like yeah. He's so scared and it's kind of a, like a, you know, no pun intended, a gut wrenching scene where he's like, every character on the screen feels terrible for him, you know, and they all realize kind of like, this is ugly. You know, what's happening to this guy is ugly. And it's the arbitrary nature of violence, you know, it's that he's sort of collateral damage, isn't he, in a way. And that is interesting. Like it's because it's such a small part. I don't think it's easy to overlook how kind of powerful the innocence of that character is. It's a great point.
Yeah. Well, you know, great movies like this that you can rewatch, you know, over and over and over every few years. And one of the things that makes a movie like that is all the little details, right? Where that like every minor character is perfectly cast and is like nailing the role. Like it's not just, you know, Clint Eastwood, Gene Hackman, Morgan Freeman, you know, all these great actors and actresses that are in the bigger roles, but even, you know, these little side characters like this guy or the Schofield kid is a little bit, you know, bigger of a character, but you know, they're all just absolutely perfect. And all these little details that you notice upon subsequent viewings, or, you know, movies like this that I rewatch every now and then pretty regularly. It also, things hit you differently because you're at different points of your life, right? The old, you know, you can't stick your foot in the same river kind of thing, right? I mean, me watching Unforgiven as a guy who's about to turn 41 in 2 weeks from tomorrow, I am a different person than me watching Unforgiven, you know, when I was in my 20s, or me watching Unforgiven, you know, for the first time when I was like 12 or something. So yeah, this is one of those movies to me, and you know, I'm sure to you as well, where when you rewatch it, depending on where you're at in your life and what you're going through, you certain things stand out to you that didn't stand out the last time you watched it, and other things that maybe you noticed, you interpret a little bit differently, and that's what, you know, that's what great movies are all about. Unlike, again, I know I sound like a cranky old man, broken record, saying, you know, how much movies of today mostly are shit, but they really are. Like it's amazing, you know. Yeah, did they make bad movies in the, to me, like the ultimate era of film, people will often say, oh, it's the 70s New Hollywood. To me, it's like that was the beginning of it. To me, the best era of Hollywood was from the 70s through into at least the early aughties. But, you know, for that period of like 3 to 4 decades there, that was kicked off by the New Hollywood. But, you know, yeah, they made plenty of shit movies, but the percentage of movies that were at least pretty good and had redeeming qualities, and then the percentage of movies that were just great, timeless, you know, classics and masterpieces was so much higher back then. I mean, just think about like how, even just the 90s, like how many just great movies that you can watch today and they're just as good and they're not dated and whatever. Whereas like, who's going to be watching Captain Marvel in the year 2050? And if you do, who's going to like it? And, you know, how is it going to age? Or is it going to seem like horribly dated? You're like, you know, you watch Captain Marvel in 2050 and you're like, oh yeah, that was when every movie had to be an intersectional feminist propaganda performance art, you know? Whereas, you know, you watch something like this, you watch something like, I don't know, Gladiator. I mean, just, you know, or even very different movies like American Psycho. Like there were just, you know, Usual Suspects, you know.
I was listening to Tim Dillon the other day and he said there's only two, in his usual hilarious way, he's like, there's only two films you can make right now and make any money. He's like, you can make some crazy woke film, you know what I mean, that's, you know, trying to push all these boundaries and push all these buttons, or you can make a superhero film. Like, those are the only two you're allowed to make right now.
Or you can blend them together and make a superhero film that has all the wokeism in it. You know, best of both worlds.
It's hilarious, but it's true. Like, the absurdity of it is what's so funny. But and it's so transparently the case, you know. But just why things were better in the past, I think it 100% has to do with freedom. As corny as cliche as that might sound, is you're no longer free to say or do so many things that we had the privilege of being able to do in the 90s and the early 2000s and people had to do in the late 80s and all these things. This is something that Carpenter's talked about, the freedom that they had in the 80s with the horror genre. He's like, we could pretty much do anything we wanted. And no, we were kind of beyond question. So, you know, you could do The Thing remake and make it incredible. You could do, you know, all these other films that he made that were incredible. You could do Escape from New York. You know, you could do Unforgiven. You could do all this stuff. You simply can't do it right now because of the constraints that contemporary society has put on free speech. You would be unpersoned, unemployable, hated, hounded, protested against. I mean, it would be, you know, a freeze out to do any of these, kind of take any of these liberties. And only with like freedom of expression and freedom of speech are you going to get good quality art. Now, I would argue, you know, I'm an anarchist. I have sensibilities, and a lot of my sensibilities are kind of a bit, I don't know, I don't want to say a bit to the right. Some of them are to the right, some of them are to the left. But great art typically does come from the left side of the spectrum, in my opinion, if you look at things historically. That being said, I also think right now the left end of the spectrum is kind of killing great art and putting the handcuffs on it. So I think that, like, while you can attribute some of the great art in the past, in fact, probably the majority of the great art in the past towards people with left-leaning sensibilities, the burden is certainly on them right now as far as the people who are stopping it and handcuffing it and watering it down and making it suck. So you do see kind of this cultural reversal where when we were growing up and when we were first becoming aware of like art and film and things like this, I think it was the left-leaning sensibilities that were at the forefront of creating it, where now it almost seems like things are kind of flipping, where it's maybe the people with the more traditional views or more right-leaning sensibilities that are craving kind of this freedom of expression and freedom of speech and things like this. And the left has taken a more totalitarian stance on it. Again, there's a lot of nuance there. I'm speaking in these extreme black and white generalities, which aren't always the case, as we both know. But if you are going to kind of encapsulate it and distill it into some generalities, that's kind of how I see the past versus the modern film industry and art industry, you know, art in general, you know, in society. And if you read one of the interesting things I had been reading, I took a break from it, but I'm going to start again. I've been reading some Will Durant histories, which is Will Durant, if you don't know, him and his wife wrote basically the history of everything up until, I want to say it's post, it might be the World War I era. I can't remember, but there's just so much history that they cover together. And it's a reference that I know Dan Carlin uses a lot. He uses a lot of Will Durant historical writings. And whenever he's writing history, he distills it down into areas of society instead of doing it chronologically. So there's family, there's warfare, or, you know, there's political discourse, and then there's art and culture. Like, that's one of the things he talks about throughout whatever period of history he's talking about. Like, that Roman Christ is what I'm starting to read now, which is about those periods in history. And if you look at, if you distill, if you forget the politics and all that, and you just look at the art itself, art and culture, and what forces in society are dominating it, changing it, I think it is very easy to see that what I would say the left side of the spectrum in society today is kind of killing art. And we desperately need a return to one of their more redeeming qualities back when we were growing up, which is, you know, the fostering and health of art they were kind of responsible for. So I would love to see from the left-leaning people a return to those kind of sensibilities of things that they used to cherish, they've kind of turned against.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. And just sort of a little bit of a sneak preview for you and to people who listen to this, once I publish it as an episode, that ties into a lot of what you were just saying is, you know, when you look at, if I'm right, that like the greatest era of American film as an art form runs from like, you know, late 60s, early 70s, kind of the beginning of New Hollywood through to the aughties. And then the 2010s is when it, you know, gradually starts to turn to shit. And really from the Trump era forward is when it just becomes totalitarian propaganda, where like literally every movie has to be, you know, a political propaganda piece of wokeism. If I'm right, that stretch of like roughly 40 years is the best American film has ever been overall. Again, most movies are shit, just like most books that are published every year are shit, but the percentage was higher of good stuff. Well, you know, looking at it historically, I can tell you why American films were so boring from the 1930s until the late 60s. And it's because of something called the Hays Code, which was the kind of nickname for the motion picture production code that was in place from the 30s until like the mid 60s. And it was very, very rigid and like micromanaged writers and directors on what they were allowed to portray and how they were allowed to portray it. I mean, right down to even details in some cases where it's like, you know, if a crime is committed during the film, it has to be solved and resolved by the end of the film. Or, yeah. You know, a couple cannot be shown together in a bedroom, even if they're, you know, depicted as married and they're clothed or, you know, just little things like that. It's just, you know, and of course, like no, you know, you're not allowed to show any interracial scenes or whatever, you know, interracial.
It was very
romance
puritanical. Yeah.
It was a straitjacket. And that's why, you know, yeah, there's a few great movies that were made in the 40s and 50s, but most movies from the 40s and 50s are just boring as hell. They're formulaic and boring as hell.
Right.
And then all of a sudden that stuff got removed in like the late 60s. And guess what? All of a sudden you had all the great, you know, auteur filmmakers coming into their own of, you know, Coppola and Milius and, you know, all the other great New Hollywood, Scorsese, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Kubrick. And then I would argue, and this is what I'm going to be covering in this solo episode that I'm still working on notes for. I characterize the Hollywood regime that's been in place for like the last, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, whatever. I call it the new Hays Code. And, you know, the new Hays Code is like, you know, no female character can ever be bested by a male character at anything. All white male characters must be either stupid or incompetent, or they must be evil, or both. Things like that, right? No female protagonist can ever learn any lessons or anything valuable from a male character or mentor, right? All these sorts of things.
Yeah, it was puritanical then, and it's now puritanical now for the new religious zealous crowd. And it's what we talked about this before the show. We were talking a little bit about it. We weren't recording or anything, but we were talking about this very thing, if you remember. About like the sort of puritanism in art and how it is making things today literally unwatchable, unreadable, unrelatable. No one really likes it. People just have to pretend to like it for political purposes, not for artistic purposes. And it really has been taken hostage by politics. And this sort of new, what we would both say is a fundamentalist religion of wokeism, just the way it was before under the initial Hays Code, kind of ruined by its sort of fundamentalist beliefs. And, you know, and this is coming from somebody who's deeply religious. You know, I, you know, very much have a belief in God, and we've discussed that before. Though it might be, there's definitely aspects of things that I would say, for me, are traditional, and I view in a different, a little bit of abstraction. But I definitely see that. I see that you know, sort of like Puritanism had kind of like ruined things previously, but I view it the exact same way now. I mean, I feel like I could spot it from a mile away, and it is interesting that parallel. And the only hope is like, when is it not going to stink again? You know.
Yeah, exactly. When is the new Hays Code going to be thrown out so that you can have actual creativity again? Because you can't, and it's the same thing, you know, same thing happened with comic books in a way too, where there was the Comics Code Authority for a long time. And, you know, yeah, there were some good comics made or whatever, but they suddenly started getting really creative when comic books started being published without the Comics Code Authority, which was sort of like the Hays Code for comic books. And so you had all these great, you know, very creative, very in some ways, you know, deconstructionist and that sort of thing, but in a good way, comic books that were published. And then now I think comic books, from what I can tell, and I was a big comic book fan in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, when I was a kid. Yeah. I didn't stick with it very much once I got to be like in high school. But, you know, from what I understand and from some of the people I follow who are into comic books, that the comic book industry got taken over by wokeism even a little bit earlier than film and television. But similar sort of a deal. So now, at least at, you know, most of the big comic book companies, it's very similar new Hays Code to Hollywood, where, you know, everything has to have wokeism shoehorned into it and everything's got to be intersectional and whatever. And, you know, any industry, whether it's film, comic books, whatever, any industry that's ultimately based on creativity is going to turn to shit as soon as you start putting a straitjacket on that industry and the people in it, you know, like there, not a lot of great art comes out of totalitarian societies. And, you know,
greatest of art, which is when it's being rebelled against, you know, right. Like that's
the true.
Only time it is good is when it's a reflection of the travesty that regime is embracing, and often too late. You know, it's never it's typically never loved in its own time. I think like a lot of people will ask me, you know, what's the best of like Rand's work or whatever, because, you know, I've read a lot of it, her stuff. And the book I always tell people to start with is We the Living, you know, which is flirts with some of these concepts about like, you know, a totalitarian regime and, you know, love or art within a totalitarian regime and the difficulties within there, which obviously Rand had a very big connection with. But a lot of times I think you're trying to say, like, what's interesting here? If everything that we're making is just a formula, like you perfectly described with the new Hays Code description, that, you know, this character has to be XYZ and this character has to be XYZ. You already know the story when you sit down. You already know what character is going to be good and what character is going to be bad. You already know who's going to learn the lesson and who isn't. You already know who's going to be magically great at everything and have... There's nothing more. I mean, like, you can look at the Rey character from Star Wars, and there's like something so irredeemable about a character with no weakness, you know, or no, that they're just so machine-like and unlikable, despite how good the performance may or may not be from the actor or actress. If there's nothing there to learn, if there's no negativity within the character, if there's no duality, like there is an Unforgiven with the characters there, then they're uninteresting. You know, I don't want to watch a film about a bunch of robots. Like, I want to get right down to the human experience. And when you remove that and you make all this stuff so formulaic, it's just garbage. And it's only the art that's going to rebel against that, like dramatically, that's going to be good. When you look back and say, hey, what's good from the 2020s? You know, what's good from the 2000, you know, teens? It's going to be the stuff that wasn't liked at the time, that was seen as toxic or whatever at the time, because it's kind of rebelling against that. It's rebelling against that sort of Hays Code-esque formula.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same as like, the original, like, earliest rock and roll in the 50s, like the early kind of like rockabilly stuff, it was hated by the establishment and the authority figures and institutions. It was hated and demonized. And the same thing when, you know, I would describe it as sort of like rock and roll kind of rediscovering its attitude with the original, you know, first punk rock bands in the 70s, where they were, you know, by that point, like kind of hippie type rock had taken over the rock music genre, right? Like Steely Dan or whatever. And then In comes Sex Pistols, Ramones, and all those sort of guys. And they're like, no, we're in a way throwing it back to the 50s. It's like the songs are going to be two, three minutes max, you know, verse, chorus, verse, maybe not even a guitar solo, but if we do, it's going to be real short and simple.
Yep.
And, you know, three chords.
And it's funny, the relationship and the love that, most people who play the guitar, we both play the guitar, but our people who love rock and roll and stuff like this, the people who love punk rock or grew up with punk rock or have an appreciation for punk rock very frequently also love rockabilly. And like, It's very close to relate. There's this YouTuber I watch who, he's got a channel called Death Ray Cat. He's like a guitar. He has like a punk rock band. I think he's British or something, but it's not really punk rock. It's more, it's like neo rockabilly kind of stuff. And he does a lot of like old rockabilly tunes, but he's also a lover of punk rock. And there's this merging of those genres and even surf rock to a point, which is sort of what I love, which is kind of, you know, rockabilly's respectable younger brother. But it's, like those are very like similar, like loved genres, where it's kind of away from the corporate, the very corporate aspects of rock and roll and the very formulaic kind of establishment version of music, you know, which is what a lot of these people who think they're the counterculture now and they're rebelling and resisting against something are really just representatives of the mainstream corporate establishment narrative. You're not the counterculture anymore. You know, the counterculture is these people who want to have, who are rebelling against all this, you know, rubber stamp garbage that you kind of see now coming out.
Yeah. I mean, it's so nauseating to, you know, see and hear people who all of their opinions line up perfectly with CNN, the CIA, Disney, Wall Street, the Pentagon, like you name it. And they label themselves the resistance. They label themselves the resistance. Like, yes, everything I say and claim to believe lines up perfectly with all of the most powerful institutions in our system. And I'm a badass rebel. And it's particularly disgusting to see how many people, individuals who used to be actually rebellious have become establishment hacks, either because of Trump derangement syndrome or because of COVID derangement syndrome or both. So like, wasn't like Jello Biafra basically propagandizing in favor of getting your Pfizer vax or something like that? I mean, it is so disgusting. Like, oh yeah, that's real punk rock. Here, do what the government and Big Pharma are telling you to do. That's how to be a badass punk rocker.
Yeah, it's very, you know, it's all about sides. It's all about, I think once you have a certain level of influence and audience, that for the most part, people just become sort of slaves to that, and they're afraid of losing it. And the most great stuff is great in the beginning, right? Until it gets big, and then it kind of gets hijacked and ruined. And that can include some of these personalities and some of these figures.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's very interesting. Like all. Where we are sort of in this, like, you know, culture cold war is very interesting. I'm excited to see kind of where it goes. I have a feeling things are going to start getting better. I do. I think I'm an optimist in that regard, especially as far as culture and art go. I think people are tired of it. I think people have had it with the formula. They see the formula doesn't work. They see the formula is insincere. They see that the formula is a lie, and that it's not true. And they can see some of the evil people and evil forces that are wielding the formula and pushing the formula. And they're like, you know, maybe I don't like this. Maybe I am okay. Maybe I don't want to look at what one person is wearing, what color their hair is, and where their piercings are, and automatically know every single political and philosophical position this person's going to hold. I don't even need to have a conversation with them, because I already know they're going to 100% agree with this other person who looks exactly like them, that is on this side of the bar. I think there is a desire to return to this society where we have some nuance and we have some ambiguity and we have some true differences, instead of this very sort of simple, I'm on this team, you're on that team. I don't know if it was Dave Smith or who it was, but somebody was talking about a Noam Chomsky quote where they said the best way to control society is to move the goalposts of allowable opinion as close together as possible, and then encourage super lively debate among those two factions. You know, make the box so small, and then encourage very lively debate. So, you know, it's either this way or this way or this way or this way, and there's no room for thinking outside of the box or nuanced opinions. And I definitely think that that's where we're at now. And I think there is a rebellion, kind of a grassroots rebellion against it, especially artistically. I think you see a lot of people doing their own upstarts. You see a lot of people kind of taking art into their own hands. And I think it's going to change. It might take a while, but I think the pendulum is ready to kind of drop back. Hopefully, as we discussed earlier before we started the show, hopefully to a more reasonable place, and that it doesn't swing back violently in the wrong direction too hard, or in the opposite direction in the wrong way too hard, where now you have a whole another set of problems to worry about that could be terrible.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want all of the hysterical progressives who actually think we're living in Handmaid's Tale to be right. You know,
exactly. And that's how we phrased it before the show. We were talking is like, I don't want this invisible enemy to become real, because the people who have been kind of eating it for the last 10 years become so incensed when the pendulum does start to swing the other way that they now cannot see what's reasonable. So I think we'll be okay. I want to believe we'll be okay, at least for a while.
Yeah, I think that the Amazon's Rings of Wokeness might be, you know, like the high tide in the sense of like the biggest, most expensive Wokeista project that falls the flattest. It might be to this whole thing what Heaven's Gate was to the new Hollywood era, you know, where it's like,
right,
it's the jumping the shark, super expensive disaster that kind of is the end of an era. So I hope I'm right. Well, yeah, man, got off on a bit of a rabbit hole, but, anything else, on Unforgiven other than what, how many stars would you give it out of, I don't know, out of 37 stars, how many would you give it?
I'll give it 37. I'll give it the top rating of whatever, if I'll give it, 3 liquor bottles, 4 prostitutes, whatever. I'll give the Joe Bob Briggs tally. Yeah. No, it's good. I love it for all the traditional reasons. I love Westerns. I love the setting. I love kind of like the romance of the era, even though a lot of it is deconstructed in the film. I still love it, just as Beauchamp still loved it in the end. He still loved seeing Will Money become that person at the end. He had that smile on his face when he was peeking around the corner as Will Money rode out of town saying that he was going to kill anyone who came after him. And if anybody harmed any of the prostitutes again, he'd come back and kill the whole town and burn the town down. And he had that smile. Beauchamp had that smile on the face that the audience had, like, finally we get our traditional hero, which had been deconstructed for the rest of the film before that. And that's how I feel about it. I love it for all the traditional reasons I love a Western, just like Beauchamp. But I also, it holds a special place in my heart for all the reasons that it deconstructs that narrative, you know, and it gets kind of meta and looks at Westerns themselves. So to me, this is the pinnacle of a great Western and probably one of the best.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. I'd give it, you know, 6 bullets in the cylinder out of 6 or whatever we're going with. And this is one of those things where, you know, I take issue with so much of the deconstructionism lately because it's just this hate-filled, nihilistic, fundamentalist, crazy, I don't even know how to describe it, like I was saying before, where it seems like these people typically have contempt for the genres and the characters they're deconstructing. Whereas Unforgiven to me is like one of the top examples of deconstruction done right and done well and done in a way that, like you were saying, you still can appreciate what it is they're deconstructing. And I don't know, you know, there's very few other films I can think of that deconstruct a genre this well without, you know, just shitting on it. And, you know, Big Trouble in Little China comes to mind, where it's kind of deconstructionist of sort of the sci-fi action kind of genre. And Cabin in the Woods, you know, good deconstruction of horror movies.
Horror films,
And those and any others I might think of, they're all ones where you can tell that the people who made them love the genre they're deconstructing. They're not doing it out of malice. They're not doing it for some sort of political agenda. They're doing it, you know,
well,
to tell an interesting
films
story.
The Coen brothers films are great about this too. Like they're all, whether it's their comedy, like Raising Arizona, or their own sort of take on the modern Western with No Country for Old Men, which is a great book. It's probably one of my favorite books by Cormac McCarthy, who's probably one of my favorite authors. But they have a few films that, whether it's like Barton Fink or whatever, that could be classified as sort of gangster-esque or whatever, that are very sort of deconstructions of those kind of things as well. So I'd love to do a Coen Brothers film with you one time too, because I love all their movies. So maybe we'll shoot to do one of those in the future one day.
Yeah. Wasn't Buster Scruggs, wasn't that Coen Brothers?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I really liked that one. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. I've got mixed feelings about No Country for Old Men, but I guess that's a debate for another time. And I have not read the book, so maybe I would like it better if I read the book, or I would like the book better. But
that's interesting anyway. That you've got it. I think it won Best Picture over There Will Be Blood, which is brilliant too. And they're two of my favorite movies. And I think they were the same year. I think what was Paul Thomas Anderson. I think that was There Will Be Blood. And then the Coen brothers doing No Country for Old Men. But I'd say the book is probably a little bit better. But I think they kind of brought their own vision to it, but it's pretty close. But I love it. I'd be interested to hear why you have mixed thoughts on it. So maybe we could do that one.
Okay. Yeah. And I haven't watched it in a long, long time. So maybe I'd have different thoughts on it now. But also I just have to ask, have you seen Old Henry?
No.
Okay. As soon as you get a chance, look up and watch the film Old Henry. I think it came out this year or maybe late last year. And it is one of the best movies I've seen in the last few years. And it actually immediately got on my list of one of my favorite Westerns of all time. And got very little attention. As you were saying, like, the good stuff now is the stuff that's under the radar. That's where you find the good stuff. Just like it is, you know, with music. The good stuff is the indie stuff. The good stuff is the stuff that doesn't get a lot of establishment attention. And yeah, Old Henry, it stars, oh man, I always forget the actor's name. The guy who was in Buster Scruggs and No Country for Old Men. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That actor with kind of the weird looking face, but he's a great actor.
I know who you're talking about. He's also, he's in, what's the bowling movie? That's funny. He's in that movie.
Jeez. Yeah. Anyway, I always forget his name, but I love him. He's a great actor, but I always forget his name. Anyway.
I heard he's like a really strong personality to work with.
Tim Blake Nelson. Tim Blake Nelson. Yeah. I knew it was a three name, first, middle, last name guy. And I can never remember his name. And I'm always like, that guy.
Oh, but yeah. You're right. He was Buster Scruggs, right?
Yeah.
Was he Buster Scruggs?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So anyway, yeah. Old Henry. He's the star of it, and it is a really cool, different kind of a Western. And I think you'll definitely enjoy
That's it. How I feel about Dead Man too. I think Dead Man is incredible.
That's one I need to rewatch. That I haven't seen that in a long time. I remember liking it, but I don't remember too much else about it. I probably haven't seen it since it came out.
Yeah, it was Jim Jarmusch film, black and white. Neil Young did the soundtrack. Johnny Depp. It's very a much more, I don't want to say realistic version of the West, but a much less glamorous, dark kind of version of that genre. It's referred to as like an acid Western. I guess it's a very, very specific genre, very, very cool film. Very cool film.
Yeah, I definitely need to rewatch that one because I remember liking it, but I don't remember a whole lot. I remembered it was Johnny Depp in black and white, but other than that, I don't remember too much of it. But anyway, well, gee whiz, I appreciate you taking all this time. And this was after what, being up all night?
Yeah. But I was working all night. So that's all right. I'm going to go, I think, take a nap. And then as we've discussed before, I'm also going to school in my spare time. So I've got to get up and do some classwork too. And then I'll get right back to work tomorrow. So full schedule for me.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and all that. Been a while since we've actually spoken, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss, you know, one of the greatest films of all time with you that we're both fans of. So, thanks for staying up early for me or whatever.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I guess. Sure. And we'll have to talk again before too long. Not let as much time go by. And you're going to take a nap. I'm going to eat lunch and, I don't know, maybe go to the gym or something like that. We'll see.
All right. Adios, man.
Good talking with you. Thank you.
say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.